Welcome to My SoCast Life, the show where we revisit my so-called life and our so-called real lives from the year when my so-called life was on the air. Did that sentence make any sense? My name is Matt Brown. I'm one of your hosts. My other host is...
Katarina.
You're not even going to go for the last name. You can't even pronounce the last name.
I'm just not going to go for it. It's not part of my stage persona.
That's fascinating.
All of my internet coordinates are Katarina G.
Okay.
I'm just going to stick with that.
I realize just now that we are Matt and Kat.
You betcha.
Which is unacceptable. So I think from now on, you will go by Uncle Gundy, and I will be Alyssa.
Deal.
Okay. Sounds good. So... this show is being brought to you on the Modern Superior Network at modernsuperior.com. It is a new podcast, limited podcast. We're going to do, unless there is a grave disaster, 19 episodes. And why? Because there were only 19 episodes of the most beautiful, perfect television series that ever existed, ABC's My So-Called Life.
Yes. Or if there's a beautiful miracle and they decide to do a My So-Called Life reunion.
Holy shit.
Then we could do an additional episode.
Like a year ago, what you just said would have been insane. But now, like, I don't know why, but all of the networks in the Netflix era have been like, we got to just keep making more. Like, there's going to be new episodes of The X-Files when we're recording this in like 6 days.
Yeah, and they're supposedly doing the Deadwood movie.
Yeah, they're doing Deadwood again.
Why
I'm really
not
interested
My So-Called Life?
The Deadwood thing, are they going to be like... Wet Hot American Summer, where they're just like, let's just pretend they haven't aged 15 years. It's the next day.
Why not?
I hope so.
That would be great.
It amuses the shit out of me. Or, you know, if you are a fan of both Justified and Deadwood, you're aware that a lot of actors from Deadwood carried over onto Justified, which has always made me think that Justified might be a fever dream that Seth Bullock has been having it like post season 3 of Deadwood.
This entire time.
So that could be the means by which you kind of claw back into a slightly altered version of the Deadwood universe where he just like wakes up and he's like, oh my God, I thought I was a marshal.
No. I often watch Homeland as though it was the continuation of My So-Called Life. And that's just what Angela Chase does now. She's just like a really emotional FBI agent or whatever.
That's why I couldn't watch Homeland. It was freaking me out. And I actually just tried to do a Felicity rewatch, and I can't watch that either because there is an episode very early in the first season where Brian Krakow shows up and rapes a girl.
Oh,
and I'm
no.
just like, I can't handle with that being what happened to Brian. Whatever happens to Brian,
it can't be what happened to Brian.
Maybe we should explain the format of our series. So yeah. What we're going to do is this. We're going to obviously do one episode per episode of My So-Called Life, where we will talk about, you know, the show as it aired, which what you were a fan of while it was on the air, and so was I, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So we were deeply into it as teenagers. Now, obviously, we are not teenagers. It was a long time ago now. So we will talk about the episode. And then I had the idea that, you know, it would be fun to really get back into the 1994 flavor by digging up our journals from the day the episode aired. And just seeing what's there.
Just diving as deep as we can into the sea of embarrassment.
Indeed. And I will preface this by saying I conceived this podcast without vetting the journals in question.
Oh, yeah. And I agreed to it without looking at mine at all. And now so, I have deep misgivings, but I'm still doing it.
Exactly. So who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's in there? I really hope there isn't much masturbation talk, but you never know. And I will read it anyway, because as I was saying before we rolled, I think the only way we're going to get through this is just owning it, just being transparent that was the people that we were, and these are the people that we are now, and that's the way it's going to be.
And we are, I think, the same age as each other, and we're within a year of the age that Angela Chase was when the show was on, right?
Right, exactly.
We're pretty much the exact same vintage, so it would have been, like, very real at the time, because that was exactly what we maybe had just gone through,
indeed,
you know, within the past 6 months kind of thing. So.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure this is true for you. This is certainly also true for me. It seems to be true for a lot of my so-called life fans, and we'll get into it a bit when we start going through the episode, but... I was one of those people that when this pilot that we'll be talking about today aired, my first thought was, oh my God, someone is writing her monologue from inside my head. Like there are things going on in this episode that I have literally thought And now they're on television.
That is exactly how I felt also.
Yes.
So, 100%. And I even had basically her same haircut and had recently dyed my hair like a weird shade of red. So
Crimson Glow?
I wish that it had actually been Crimson Glow. But yeah, so I was, not only was the show speaking from inside my head, but I remember people in my high school commenting that I looked like the character on this new show. Mm-hmm. So it was very eerie. It was an eerie experience.
Yeah. My best friend, Amanda, also with the dyed red hair, very frequently was like, oh, you're Angela Chase. And, you know, and conversations that we would all have were just very my so-called life-esque. I think this is probably why the series became intensely, intensely beloved by the people who loved it.
Yeah.
And why its cancellation was heartrending.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also not that surprising because we are clearly the weirdos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that is why we identified with this show. Oh, and that is why there are not enough of us to sustain a, you know, TV program being on the air for a long time.
Yeah. Well, what was weird was apparently they started syndicating it like 2 or 3 years later on MTV. And that's when it became really popular. But it was like, if they had just thought of that as an opportunity when it was on the air, they could have more than justified keeping it on the air. It was just as a network family drama, whenever it was, like 8 o'clock on Thursday nights, it just didn't make sense at all.
Yeah.
And it was up against like ER, you know? So it's like, it's just impossible for them to survive.
Yeah. I had forgotten about the juggernaut that ER was at the time.
I think they were probably up against Friends in terms of time slot, but yeah.
So yeah,
like
even worse.
They were doomed. Like there was no getting out of this problem for them. Did you join the letter writing campaign?
I don't think I did actually, but probably just out of laziness.
Yeah.
Like just, or like procrastination.
Yeah.
Definitely not out of a lack of desire.
Right on. All right. So why don't we start kind of working our way through the pilot? Scene by scene, blow by blow. You'll have to, while we're recording this, listeners, the pilot is on a TV in front of us. We're going to have to ignore that because it's probably going to go at a different speed from us. But I will start this by saying, how old was I when this show was on the air? I think I was probably 16 or 17. I had obviously watched some adult skewing programming at that time. But I don't think I'd ever seen a series that looks and behaves like this. So this pilot, even at the time, really impressed me as just kind of a piece of visual storytelling. Mm-hmm. And still today, I'm like, wow, this is a really well-directed piece of TV.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. It was definitely not. And I had watched unusual shows. Like I was a fan of Twin Peaks. You know, I had seen shows that didn't seem like regular primetime TV, mm-hmm. but I was still pretty bowled over by this pilot. I just remember thinking, A, it was not like anything I'd seen before, and B, it was definitely unlike anything I'd seen before that dealt with teenagers.
Right.
In that it was the only thing I'd ever seen that seemed even remotely related to what real life was like.
Yeah, exactly. And we're talking about the era when literally the class of Beverly Hills 90210 had just graduated from high school the previous summer.
Yep.
That was what teen drama was. And our cohorts at modernsuperior.com have done a very extensive rewatch of Beverly Hills 90210, and they're frequently astonished by how hilarious it all seems. But, you know, as someone who grew up while that was the normal, it didn't really seem that funny at the time. It was just normal, you know?
Yeah.
Like that's what teen drama was like. And then my so-called life showed up and was like, oh, it can be this whole other poetic, soul-searing examination of sort of what it's actually like to be that age.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And I was a fan of 90210 when I was in my younger teens, but I don't think I ever thought of it as a show that spoke to me mm-hmm. in any real, like it wasn't about my life. It was just enjoyable entertainment
right.
with occasionally, you know, some issues thrown in that kind of were similar to some things that I dealt with, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just normal. That was what teen shows were like. They were either that or they were sitcoms. And this was just a completely new category.
Right. Here's the CanCon question of the week. Were you a Degrassi fan?
I was, but my family moved here when I was 11, so I didn't grow up with Degrassi when I was a kid. And so I caught up with it a little bit in my preteen and early teen years. But I didn't have enough of the context of like the history of the show or even just Canadian culture enough to be as into it as some of my peers. But I definitely was a fan and I definitely was regularly shocked. And now when I sometimes rewatch Degrassi, I'm even more shocked by how many issues they actually tackled on that show and how regularly they were like really kind of aggressive about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did like Degrassi for sure.
Right on. So let's start kind of going through the episode. The episode begins with the girls whispering "Go now," which actually becomes the opening of the opening credits and all of subsequent episodes. But right now leads into an actual scene where they're trying to bum change on the street or something like that. Angela and her best friend, Rayanne Graff.
And it's not explained why they're bumming change on the street, but I actually remember trying to bum change on the street with my friend when I was 15. And it was because we were like trapped at a mall and didn't have bus fare. And we were trying to raise like 50 cents to get enough for two bus tickets to get back home without having to like phone our parents and be like, we are so incompetent that we lost the dollar that it was going to cost us to get back home. And it was just that awkward and stupid. And we laughed just that much. And then we eventually found a fountain that people had thrown change into.
Oh my.
And we fished out two quarters and got on the bus.
Well done.
Yeah.
Based on everything that happens in the episode, particularly stuff that, and I'll try not to think ahead about future episodes too much, but given what we know about Rayanne, by the way, the Duchess AJ Langer playing Rayanne, she's apparently now a literal
Lady
Duchess in the UK.
Wow. Very impressive.
Odd. Married into the royalty. Given what we know about them, I kind of feel like they're just doing it to do it. Like they're just doing it to screw around with people and see if they can make it work. And, and it's kind of a laugh for them and so on and so forth. It's one of the only times we ever see Angela with her blonde hair.
Yeah.
The big reveal that's coming up before the credits roll is the dyeing of the hair bright red. So, like I said, it's one of the best directed pilots I've ever seen. So we go into this montage where we get the first of the Angela voiceovers and we're kind of going through her experience of high school kind of in these slow motion hallway shots of people being weird. And she's talking about how cheerleaders don't make sense. And one of my favorite things, and maybe you can tell me how you feel about it, this thing where girls aren't supposed to notice boys noticing them, like guys just have it easier because they can just stare at women and women can't stare back.
Yes.
Yeah. I really admire that.
I really, on rewatching it, really loved the line where when she's dyeing her hair, where she's like, Rayanne told me that my hair was holding me back.
Yeah.
And I felt like, yeah, I felt that way about my hair too. Yeah,
I don't get that. What does that mean? Like, what is it holding her back from, do you think, in that moment?
It's like her hair is this mousy reminder of her old self that she doesn't want to be anymore. Mm-hmm. And she needs a new, like, face to greet the world with. Yeah. And hair is the easiest way to achieve a noticeable dramatic change without doing anything particularly drastic, and you don't have to buy a whole new wardrobe. You can just change your hair. It's easy, but it changes the way everyone looks at you, and it's like it's just like turning over a new page in your life. And that's what she's doing. She's abandoning her old friends. She's got this new crew and her hair is holding her back. It totally made sense to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And what's one of my favorite images from this thing that I kind of forgotten about is later in the episode when she goes to the party, which we will talk about in more detail because of that party I have questions about.
Me but, too.
Yeah. When she goes to the party, she's basically like wearing like a church dress, right? Like this adorable little flowery dress that, you know, was probably the nicest thing she has. But, you know, yes, she's made this change to her hair, but the rest of her physical appearance kind of hasn't caught up yet to that.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look at her and her like old best friend, Sharon, who hates the new hair, which is like, you know, part of the point of the whole change is that everyone notices and everyone realizes that now there's no place in her life for them. But like the two of them, other than the hair, don't really look that different. They're still basically dressing similarly for most of that episode. It's just like Angela's different because of the hair.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in the voiceover at the beginning, we've got, you know, I kind of picked up the thread this time of sort of like what's going through all of the things she says, which is kind of like it's almost the catcher in the rye thing where she's sort of debating the difference between phoniness and authenticity. But the thing where I think she's getting trapped all the time is she just doesn't know where her authentic self is. So that's, in one sense, that's why I find it kind of odd that she does do something as drastic as dyeing her hair, because I'm like, how did you know this is a thing that will help define you, other than, like you said, being the flag that she wears on her head that says, I'm not like what you used to think that I was.
Yeah. You know?
But like the cheerleader line for me is very instructive. Like, can't we just cheer on our own? She's like, she's resisting all these ideas of, you know, being told how to behave, being told how to feel about things, basically. And that sort of goes through everything that happens to her in this episode.
Mm-hmm. And that rings so true to me, just that kind of simultaneously profound and like shallow realization that the world expects certain things of you, and that mm-hmm. maybe that's not who you wish to be, and just how incredibly dramatic that seems when it's the first time that you're having that thought.
Yeah.
Like, it's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, so like in terms of the writing, I guess that's sort of the thing that I'm embarrassed to say, at the time I would have been like, every word of the voiceover in this is just so true. It's so on model. It's so right. It expresses how I feel exactly. As an adult looking back at it, I can be like, so say there's the linchpin line right at the end of the first act. School is a battlefield for your heart. At the time, again, I would have been like, yes, it is. Thank Correct. You very much. That is absolutely accurate. Now I can be like, that is also incredibly overdramatic, way over the top, incredibly narcissistic. You know, like yep. this idea that this entire process somehow revolves around your attempts to define who you are and find your own happiness. And it's that line that the writing continuously dives back and forth on that I just think is so skillfully done, because Winnie Holtzman, who I guess we're going to talk about a lot in this series,
mm-hmm.
really found that voice where it's both accurate to the teen experience and also as an adult, you're like, oh, come on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's so darling. So she's incredibly small in this, Claire Danes. Like, she was 13 when they shot the pilot.
And she looks so young.
Yeah.
I at the time, I mean, I was around that age and I felt like she looked similar in yeah. age to my peers. And I didn't think of her as looking that young. And when I rewatched it now, I was like, oh my God, she's an actual child.
Yes.
And that is also kind of an unusual thing in shows about TV shows or shows about teens. Sorry. The casting of actual teens
yes.
is not always something they do. I mean, the 90210 cast is like a perfect example. Those guys looked 30
mm-hmm.
and she looks like a child. They yeah, were. Exactly.
And I mean, it's a very difficult thing to do. The reason they cast older for teens is the whole, you know, union regulations and how long can they work. And there are a lot of teens, air quotes, in the show that are in their 20s. I think Rianne mm-hmm. and Sharon are both in their 20s. But yeah, she was 13. And then, like, when they started shooting the actual show, I think she was almost 14, nearly 15. Like, it all happened over a long period of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel very awkward now about the degree to which I was incredibly infatuated with Angela Chase when I was 16, 17. Because I was like, oh, my God. She was, like, my sister's age.
Well, it's funny how much younger she looks, too, in the one scene before her hair is dyed. Like, she really looks yes. little.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so we'll talk about this a lot as the show goes on, but the horrible realization that actually kind of drove me to want to do this show is that I am now, I'm 39, I am now officially older than Tom Erwin, Graham Chase, was shooting the show.
Whoa.
He was 38. So I'm that guy now, I'm older than him. And he was like my favorite when I was a kid. Like, I mean, I was like, why isn't my dad like this guy? I'm going to be a big Graham truther, because watching this episode again, I was like, oh, he's a bad guy. Like, he's cheating on his wife. Like, there's bad things going on here that I just refuse to kind of, it's funny the degree to which I refuse to acknowledge what was happening with Graham
at the time. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Cause it's pretty clear at the end of the episode and we can talk more about it, but like, yeah. He was like hero to me. And now it's like, I'm 39. I'm older than he was then. I don't have a family. You know, my life has kind of gone in a different direction from all that. But like that moment of being like, oh my God, like he's actually younger than me, let alone all of the teenagers are obviously like a third of my age right now. So
yeah, that's it's crazy.
Freaky.
Was he, I mean, I don't, you know, we probably don't have the answer to this question, but were he and the mom supposed to be playing that young, or were they playing older? Like, were they super young parents in the show? Well, or was he supposed to be sort of like in his 40s or whatever?
Bess Armstrong is a couple years older than he is. So I think she was like 41, 42 when they were shooting this. So I assume that they're supposed to be around there. Mm-hmm. But like the idea that they probably had Angela when they were 27 isn't, you know,
that's not crazy.
Doesn't seem that unusual. And then they had Danielle a few years later.
Yeah.
Danielle, who becomes one of my favorite characters as the show goes on. Like, she's so consistently well-written for being so pissed off that no one is paying attention to her at all.
She's actually amazing. Even in the pilot, like, I remember not noticing her much in the early episodes back when I watched it back in the day. And I remember kind of thinking, oh yeah, annoying younger sister, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But now watching the pilot, I was like, she is hilarious and I love her.
Yes.
And I can't wait for there to be more of her because she is so funny and like perfectly written.
Yeah, she's
and
wonderful.
So mad.
She's just, so mad. It's great. Literally does a handstand in this one because no one's paying attention to her. She stands on her hands and her feet are sticking up in the back of a shot because no one's paying attention to her.
It's so good.
So... School's a battlefield for your heart. She changes her hair. And then we have the introduction of Patty, her mother, with the, you know, she sees the hair for the first time and gives one of my very favorite lines of all time, which is she's so flabbergasted that she just says, here is some cheese and kind of just walks out of the room. And so this sets up sort of the primary antagonism, I guess, of the whole show, which is Angela versus Patty. It's a very complicated, very, like I said, antagonistic relationship, particularly at this point.
Yeah.
So I guess the question I have to ask you is this just teenage girls and their moms?
For sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I was looking through the diaries from around that time, so many of my entries are about how I was so misunderstood by my parents and mm-hmm. couldn't get along with my mom and she doesn't get me and she's so critical and just all of this overwrought emotion that was just so over the top mm-hmm. and so heightened needlessly. But yeah, a lot of it was just about how I wasn't getting along mm-hmm. with my mom. And in retrospect, I mean, I remember not getting along with my mom, but most of it was probably over things that were so minor that were blown up in my head.
Yeah.
Into this insane degree that yeah. made it seem really like, oh, how can I stand another day in this house of, you know, everyone is trying to ruin my life. It's like not.
Well. As you Angela know? Says in like the next scene, nowadays I can't even look at my mother without wanting to stab her repeatedly. And it's like, it wasn't my mom for me, it was my dad, but it was the same thing where it's like looking back on it, like in and around this, maybe a year prior to the show being on the air, I made a movie, which I did a lot of back then. I made one movie that everyone really, really liked. And anytime anyone came over to the house, my dad wanted me to show it to them. Drove me nuts. Like I was so... angry, like furiously angry to the point where I would make other movies and not tell him. And I would literally, I'd be making them to be like, he's not going to know this exists. So he can't do that to me. It's such a lovely thing.
So you were basically furious that your dad was proud of you.
That he was proud of me and he liked what I was doing and yeah. wanted to show it off and was and support me in doing this thing. You know? Like,
yep.
It's
How
insane.
Dare he?
It's insane, right? And it's that kind of mental... pretzel that I guess you get yourself into. I don't even know where that kind of thinking starts, except that you're trying to establish your identity, so you're pushing against all of these existing identity ideas. So silly.
It's so good that we get over that stuff.
It is. I fear for people who don't.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So the next thing that happens, I guess, is another parent-child thing, which is that we have the scene with Angela and Graham and Angela's boobs. Where Angela's going from bathroom to bedroom in a towel and Graham loses his shit. Maybe at the time I was like, okay, that makes sense. Now I feel like maybe he loses his shit a little bit too much.
Yeah, I at the time don't think I really noticed that scene particularly, but when I watched it this time I was like, that's a disproportionate amount of awkwardness. This is your kid. Like, I don't remember having any moments like that with my dad. Mm-hmm. And I don't particularly remember my girlfriends having moments like that with their dads because it's your dad. They don't notice you. That's not a thing. They notice that you're changing and growing up. And sometimes that can be hard, you know, to deal with whatever. You're not a little girl anymore. But I feel like it's not obvious in that kind of day-to-day interaction way.
Yeah.
It was that was actually kind of the one moment in the pilot that I was like, that seems odd.
Yeah. Especially for me, she, you know, maybe this is unfair of me to say, but she's like, the sad truth is my breasts have come between us. And I'm like, oh, honey, what breasts? You know, like she's, again, she's 13. She's like a small child.
She's
I'm like,
tiny,
you know what?
Gangly child.
Yeah, exactly. There's not really, you know, it's not a lot happening there. Maybe they thought they were going to cast a different kind of actress for that role. I don't know. But in any event, we get into, so we have Patty and Graham talking about various cultural references like Chelsea Clinton and Axl Rose. And then we go off to school.
Memories.
And we meet the man I hated so much as a teenager, Jordan Catalano, played by now very famous, soon to be a Joker, Jared Leto.
Who knew that he would be the like most successful one sort of out of that whole group? I mean, Claire Danes is doing well for herself now, but for a while there, she was kind of, you know, not on the radar that much.
Yeah.
I never would have guessed that Jordan Catalano would be the one who would be the breakout.
Like even
star.
When he was in Fight Club, I was like, that's a weird pull. Like it's weird that he's here. Like he hasn't been doing anything else. Like why is he here? And then he disappeared for another 7 or 8 years and then started doing like Oscar roles. It's very bizarre.
So weird.
The funniest thing about this is that this character that the Jordan that he becomes later, you know, with the grunge clothes and the big leather jacket and the long hair. That's who they wanted him to be in this episode.
In the first place, yeah.
Here, he's a dork. He's got his short hair, his little striped jersey, you know, his jeans. It's like, oh, he's so pathetic. He's not interesting at all. Like, how could anyone even have noticed him?
He just seems so dumb.
Yeah.
And I know that that's partly sort of the point.
Oh, it's entirely the point.
But he just seems so dumb that even at the time I remember thinking, I can't relate to this crush because he's not interesting enough to obsess over. Mm-hmm. I can relate to the idea of obsessing about a boy, but for a reason.
Yeah.
Any kind of reason, like something to hold on to. And he was just this empty vessel for her, you know, desires and neuroses, which also makes sense. I get that. But yeah, he was just so, he did a great job of playing like the stupidest.
Yeah. Totally boy. Vacant, absent, has no idea what's going on. And it infuriated me as a guy who was unpopular with the ladies. I was basically Brian. Like, well, you know, we'll get there, but that's the reality is I was, if there's a character here that I was kind of like a, maybe a 10%, 90% mix of Ricky Brian, you know? So
that sounds
like,
great.
I had no Jordan, but I was familiar with this sensation where all these girls that I knew that were, you know, relatively soulful, insightful people, or as much as you can be at that age, as Angela has been demonstrating, would just get over the moon excited about these just vacant matinee idol idiots. And it would just drive me crazy. So Jordan like drove me crazy as well. Cause I was just like, this guy, oh, he's so not worth it. Like he's just so dumb.
Yeah.
But I guess that's kind of the point too.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, this is kind of jumping way ahead in the episode, but I like the fact that when Angela finally gets to spend like alone time with him, she also kind of realizes that he's dumb, but doesn't necessarily change anything or stop her or change her feelings about him, because that's not how being a teenager works.
Right.
But it's not even like, it's a fact. It's obvious even to her, like what he actually is.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of quotable lines, obviously the show is full of them. Either sex or a conversation, ideally both, is still to this day something I will say about, like, do you want to, you know, talk to that person? You want to get to know this person? It's like, yeah, I mean, sex or a conversation, ideally both would be the, you know.
For me, it is, you're so beautiful, it hurts to look at you.
Has anyone ever actually said that to you prior to the deed?
No, and I don't think I've ever said it to anyone in seriousness, but I've definitely said it many times over the last 20 years.
Yes.
There are so many occasions on which it's appropriate.
It's a very portable line.
It is.
Okay, so what else happens? We get the start of the Sharon conflagration, which kind of starts out a little bit cool with them just being like, what happened to your hair? That's kind of weird. And then the yearbook thing where Brian is doing something that in today's day and age, you probably would need to ask permission to do, which is just taking a lot of photos of this girl that he has a crush on. And probably developing them in the dark room in his basement and hanging them up.
Probably.
We can imagine. And oh, one of my favorite little details is the moment where they're talking in the bathroom, where Rayanne and Ricky and Angela do all their plotting. They're talking in the bathroom. Angela runs off to go to class, and then they just pan over, and there's a girl just in the hallway sobbing.
Just sobbing.
And I was like, that is so real. That happened.
100%.
That totally happened in high school. You'd just be going somewhere, and you'd be like, what's going on over there? That's weird. Wouldn't stop. Wouldn't do anything about it, but... You know, everyone had their little drama somewhere.
Definitely.
So that's all good. Also, in terms of very obvious and very accurate, I love the shot that pans over the neon light in the English teacher's class to express the boredom and frustration of being in high school. I was like, that moment where the only thing you can hear is the buzz.
Yeah.
That's very real to me, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
Yeah. And then we have something that became actually kind of controversial when the episode aired. Not controversial, but one of the things I remember the reviews mentioning, which is that Angela Chase idolizes Anne Frank and that she says that Anne Frank is lucky.
Because she gets to spend time locked in an attic with a boy she really likes.
That is correct.
Amazing.
Yeah. And she expands upon it very nicely later, where she's explaining to the cop why she actually likes Anne Frank. But in that moment, it's such a stupid thing to say that you're surprised the teacher even has a problem with it.
You know? Like, you would think in real life, a teacher would just kind of roll with that because it's so dumb and probably not the first time that something that dumb has been said in class.
Yeah.
That you'd have to kind of shrug and move on instead of actually getting upset.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's one of the moments that is a great... example of what I really related to with Angela as a character, which is that she's articulate in her internal monologues and totally incapable of expressing herself in actual life to the people around her.
Yes.
Occasional moments of clarity, that conversation with the cop is one of them, you know, once in a while with her friends, but most of the time just can't verbalize any of the things that she's feeling or thinking, even though they are clear emotions inside of her,
mm-hmm.
but they come out just as a mess.
Yeah. A tortured mess. And Claire Danes really delivers the shit out of it, where she really sounds like she's really working out what she's trying to say. Like the monologue that ends the yearbook teacher monologue, like when she gets held back after class and she describes the whole thing about, you know, why she finds it troubling that you're agreed to have a personality and that she thinks it's just so other people find it easier to deal with you, which is actually pretty insightful. It's true that, mm-hmm. you know, we stereotype and categorize everything that we come in contact with trying to make sense out of it. And then she ends with if we made a book of what really happened, it would be a really upsetting book. It's like, that is one of those perfect moments where it's like, yes, that is insightful, but you sound like a moron.
Exactly.
It's just, it's so beautiful that again, Winnie Holtzman kind of had the courage to write her lead character that way.
Yeah, it's definitely the disconnect between what is happening inside your brain and what comes out of your mouth is something that I really related to with Angela. I always felt like I have these feelings about why, like I know why I'm so sullen and angsty, but I can't express it in a way that isn't the stupidest. Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
Yeah.
So in terms of quotable lines, another one that I use constantly is the con carne with meat declaration.
That's a great moment.
I know a lot of vegetarians, a lot of vegans, I've been presented with, and I have no problem with their people. They're fine. But I've been presented with a lot of meatless chili in my life, and I will always, 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 always say... chili con carne. Con carne with meat. this is the point where I kind of want to address something that will be kind of a through line in the whole show, which is the Patty Graham relationship. Because this is the scene where, so Graham's talking to Angela alone in the kitchen. And Angela turns away from Graham and she's describing the way Patty gets angry. And Tom Irwin plays it really nicely behind her, where he kind of smiles. He recognizes what she's saying. He's impressed and proud that his daughter is old enough and sort of self-aware enough that she's able to, that she knows Patty that well. And it also speaks to a problem that runs through the entire Patty Graham relationship, which is that basically Graham feels smothered by Patty. like feels overmanned by Patty. And there's a great line earlier where Graham's trying to kind of calm Patty down and says, oh, it could be a lot worse. She could be doing drugs, having sex like we were in high school. And Patty immediately says, you never had sex in high school. Like, she's constantly emasculating Graham and not kind of letting him have any male fictions that kind of would allow him to prop up his ego. Now, I'm not saying all this to mitigate the affair that we will have to discuss at the end of the episode, but it's nice to see all the ways that this dynamic between the two of them is kind of played out, but not directly. You know what I'm saying? Like, it gets addressed very subtly throughout the episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I liked both Patty and Graham when I watched the show at the time. They weren't like my parents, but they were relatable, and I felt like I had similar conflicts with my parents that Angela had with them. But I didn't, like, when I watched it this time, obviously from an adult perspective, I saw the cracks in their relationship so much more, and I had so much more sympathy for both of them, and I've really felt for them in this entirely new way, and kind of was like, man, that's rough. Like, that's, they're having a hard time, and it's not, I mean, they don't have the option to, it's like they're having a hard time in their own relationship, but they don't have the option for that to be really their focus, because they're raising a teenager, which is hell anyway.
Yeah.
And they have this other child who nobody pays attention to, right, who's really mad about it.
And they're running a business together.
Exactly. In the background. And they're trying to, you know, run a business and support their family and all of this kind of thing. And it was definitely watching it now, I felt a lot more sympathetic in general towards them. And kind of like, I get it.
There's a moment where Patty is chewing Graham out for letting Angela go to the party, and he just throttles the hand towel that he was using to dry the dishes. Like, he strangles it right in front of her. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Bad times.
Bad times. Bad times indeed. So let's talk about this party.
Yeah.
Who the fuck that did you know when you were a teenager in Pittsburgh, you weren't, but say that you were, who not only has a live band with a spotlight play their backyard party, but does it on a Thursday night?
Literally no one.
Right?
That person does not exist.
Doesn't exist.
Yeah. That band looked pretty authentic. I feel like when my high school had a battle of the bands or something, a lot of the bands of the era looked a lot like those guys.
Yeah.
And other than that, nothing about that party was familiar.
Yeah,
I didn't go to a ton of parties in high school, but for sure, I don't know anyone who had access to a house where the neighbors wouldn't complain about a live band in the backyard on a Thursday night and a bunch of drunk teenagers. That's just crazy.
I think probably when this episode aired, I had never seen a live rock band play like in a backyard. Right?
Yeah,
like,
definitely me neither.
So I don't think I really understood how loud that actually is, you know, like
that's a good point.
Blocks away loud. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, like I'm like, why is this place not just like crawling with cops? And and why, to move on to the next scene, why is Jordan sitting alone inside the house watching the I Touch Myself music video on silent with nobody else there? Like, what is he doing?
Yeah, what is wrong with that guy?
Seriously, like, that's where you start to be like, is he brain damaged? Like, is he just literally colored lights on screen? She comes in, he doesn't know what day it is. He's not doing anything. He's waiting for his friends to be like, let's get out of here. He's like, okay, let's get out of here. You know, like, he's just like, is he a zombie? Who is this guy?
Basically, he is.
Yeah, I guess so.
he's... I don't know if that... I don't, even now rewatching it, I don't know if that scene was supposed to make him seem, you know, mysterious and interesting, or whether it's supposed to just make him seem laughably ridiculous.
Yeah.
But definitely, what is he doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Okay, let's talk about our good friend Sharon Chersky, who, like many characters on this show, the first time you watch it, just sort of seems like an annoying loser. And I remember the first time I watched, I kind of didn't like Patty either, and you know, like all the people that you're supposed to, if you identify with Angela, all the people that Angela's kind of against in this episode, you're against.
Yep.
Except I think Sharon is amazing now, where I'm like, She's totally herself. She calls Angela on her bullshit immediately. She doesn't change her views or her values just to get her friend back, who is, you know, her friend is like vacillating all over what she wants to be, who she wants to hang out with. Like Sharon, who has kind of a very interesting arc in the season as well, is in a lot of ways substantially more mature than Angela.
Oh, yeah.
And you mistake it because she's dressed like a church girl and she, you know.
Yeah, so and she seems annoying and like she's holding Angela back. But in reality, she has her shit figured out.
Yeah.
So much more.
So much more.
She is a far more mature and reasonable person.
Yeah.
And yeah, and she actually is one of the relatively few characters on the show who actually doesn't care what other people think about the way she looks or whatever and doesn't change to suit new friends or like she's just actually very kind of solid.
Yeah. And she's also, I mean, again, I haven't watched the show in a long time. Hopefully this isn't a spoiler for anybody. Good Lord, if you're watching, if you're listening to this episode and you haven't watched My So-Called Life, you should watch it. But
I question why anyone would listen to this if they hadn't watched it. But,
exactly.
But hey, to each their own.
But I think Sharon's the only person in the core group that basically establishes a normal sexual relationship, like a healthy sexual relationship before the end of the season. Right? Like she gets a boyfriend. She has a sexual relationship with the guy. It's not a big deal. She doesn't get pregnant. She doesn't have an abortion. She doesn't get raped. None of that stuff happens. You know,
yeah.
Like, it's just sort of like she's actually mature enough that she's ready to make that decision. Whereas,
and it goes fine.
And it goes fine. Whereas Angela,
I think you're right,
isn't.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's like, so why? I mean, I know why Angela is the protagonist, but it's one of those moments where when you step outside protagonist worldview for a second, you're like, oh yeah, this person's way cooler. I'd hang out with Sharon.
Yeah. We say that because we're old now.
Yeah, exactly. That's so speaking of being old now, I like the fact that they do not call immediate attention to the fact that Ricky uses the girls' washroom and wears eyeliner until Patty completely freaks out about it.
Yeah.
And then we have a hilarious, quaint little scene where Angela says, well, maybe he's bi, and Patty is like, bi?
What?
Do you hear these words she's using? And I was like, is there really a time where anyone saying bi would have been wildly outside the norm of family discourse? I guess there was. I guess this was all very new in 94.
I guess so. I mean, at the time, do you remember, like, were there any kids at your high school who were openly gay?
There was. He had just come out, I believe, probably actually the same year that My So-Called Life was on the air. And he actually, oddly enough, I work with him now.
That is a neat coincidence.
Yeah, we hadn't seen each other in like 10 years. And then he just, you know, started working where I work. And yeah, it's, but like that was just starting to become, but it's not like, good Lord, it's not like those people invented homosexuality. It had been around for a very long time. But I guess the idea that it could be part of normal teen life was still
pretty
fairly new.
Yeah, because at my high school, there were a couple of guys who were out that I was aware of. Maybe there were more that I didn't know about, but there were a couple that I was aware of because they were friends with one of my best friends, which was also very kind of familiar in watching the show. I kind of thought like, oh yeah, I don't really have a Ran and a Ricky, but I kind of have a semi Ran and she's got a couple of Rickies and like, I get it. But yeah, I think it was still relatively new and it was, I guess, new enough that it wasn't necessarily something that you would openly discuss with your parents, unless you had exceptionally cool parents at the time who made a point of telling you that they, you know, that homosexuality was something that is normal and that they're okay with. You know, kids struggled with coming out. And I think kids also struggled with, you know, introducing their families to friends who were different or friends, you know, that kind of thing, because maybe because you wouldn't know what the reaction would be because it had never come up before. And it was not as common sort of in the everyday discourse, you know.
Yeah.
There weren't really TV characters in mainstream TV that were openly gay. It was something that you kind of had to encounter in real life in order to think about, as opposed to it just kind of being around in the popular culture to the same degree that it is now.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see a mom freaking out, not even necessarily because of homophobia, but just because it's because you're being forced to deal with sexuality in a way that relates to your child,
yep.
You know, and in a way that's not maybe familiar, and it's freaky, and it kind of makes the whole situation feel like, oh, they're growing up and they're encountering unfamiliar things. Mm-hmm. And this is not like it was when I was their age, and I don't know how to cope with this, and I don't know how to cope with this person. I kind of get it. But watching that scene now, I felt like, really? It seems so kind of like mm-hmm. funny and quaint that she was like, bye. I mean, really?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not sure, and you know, maybe listeners can correct us if we're wrong. I kind of feel like Ricky was probably, if not the first, but one of the first gay characters on mainstream television. Like, he was, I mean, like, yeah, there was Billy Crystal on Soap, for example, but in terms of like a drama, he probably would have been pretty cutting edge. And I think it is interesting that they really do refuse to define exactly what is going on with Ricky for a very long time in the show. Like, yes, he uses the ladies' room, but his two best friends are girls. Yes, he wears eyeliner, but they really don't kind of get into why. Like, they never discuss it. Like, they never discuss why he does it. They never have a scene in the whole season where he's like, oh, I just think it looks nice or something like that. You know, like, they never, it never becomes a point of discussion.
Yeah.
So they kind of ease you into this. I mean, basically, I think the best word you could use to describe him is he's queer. They ease you into this character who is clearly queer and also clearly trying to figure out exactly how he wants to define himself too, but it's going to take him a really long time
for sure
to get there.
Yeah. And the thing I loved, even at the time, I loved the fact that they never really discussed it or acknowledged it. Like, it was just a normal thing between them as friends. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, Ricky wears eyeliner. Why would we have to talk about it?
Yeah.
You know, and that was awesome. I really liked that.
Exactly. So now we kind of have a scene with Brian. So Angela's going to go out with Rayanne again, second night in a row. I don't know if I believe this. Going to go to a rave at Let's Bolt, which if you look 13, I don't even understand why you thought you could pull it off, but whatever. Before she goes, though, she must pass the threshold guardian that is Brian Krakow, who apparently rides in a circle on his bicycle outside her house all night long, just in case.
Poor Brian.
She comes out. And for a moment watching the episode today, I was like, Brian is almost a Sharon character, because he does say things that are very right in that moment. He's like, you're being an idiot. You know, what you're doing is stupid. But what I like about Devin Gummersall's performance here is that he does all that, but he does it with just a bit of quiver in his voice, which communicates to me that he's actually just pissed off that Angela's kind of moving outside of what he understands.
Yeah. Yeah. And Brian's such an interesting character. And at the time, I remember I didn't have like a Brian type person in my life specifically.
You do now. Hi.
But I mean, in the sense that it was, you know, someone who I had known forever and who was like in love with me. And you know what I mean? Like that kind of a friend in high school. I had, you know, high school was confusing, and sometimes you have a crush on someone, sometimes they have a crush on you, and sometimes it doesn't work out and whatever. But I don't think that there was anyone in my life who was like an old friend who had developed feelings for me that I sort of knew about but didn't acknowledge and exploited in various ways.
Right.
That's a pretty common kind of unfortunate teenage reality. I feel like I know a lot of people who had those kind, who were on one side or the other of that kind of frustrating relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I didn't have any direct experience with that kind of thing, I remember at the time feeling like Brian was so oppressive in a way. Mm. Like he really, not that he was somehow trying to hold her down, but that just his presence was this suffocating thing for her. And I could really relate to that. The idea that other people who have good intentions and who care about you can be unbearable to deal with sometimes. Mm-hmm. because you just don't know how to take positive feelings from others, and you don't know how to accept, you know, decent treatment and that kind of thing. And it was, and now watching it, I really like Brian. I feel like he's honest and he says a lot of things that are very correct, and he's kind of aware of what the reality is between him and Angela, but he's still sort of funny. He sort of takes it in stride. Mm-hmm. He's not pathetic in the way that he seemed to me at the time. He's actually like more interesting than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to have an interesting ride with Brian as we go through the series, because, you know, he was a character I obviously very strongly identified with at the time, because I really was the, you know, the nerd that was pining away after various friends of mine and so on and so forth. And obviously, you know, a lot of shared common interests between Brian and myself. But in this post-Gamergate world, there's also a degree to which I see in Brian the beginnings of that sort of entitled nerd rage around the way he does think about Angela and talk to Angela. And, you know, we'll deal with it when we get to Life of Brian, because it really kind of gets into the degree to which Brian, bless him, has no idea how to deal with women at all. So we will get there, but, you know, it is... There are aspects of what he says to her when he comes out there that are shamey, you know?
Like, for sure.
You shouldn't be wearing those clothes. You shouldn't be doing this thing.
Better before.
Yeah, you were better before, exactly. Like, yeah. You shouldn't be like this. You should be like what I want you to be like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's totally true. That's a really good point.
I do love Brian, and, you know, I feel like he redeems himself at the end of the episode when Angela comes back. But there's going to be some tricky times ahead.
Definitely.
With Mr. B. So let's talk about when Angela comes back when she... So here's the thing. I swear to you, when I was a teenager and Angela sees Graham talking to the woman around the corner, I really... Because, again, I liked Graham. I believed in Graham. I was like, he's probably just seen this woman a couple of times. You know, like, they probably worked together or something. And she probably wants to have a relationship with him. And he's like, no. As an adult now who has had a relationship with a married person, he's very clearly breaking up with someone he's had a lot of sex with outside his marriage. I'm so devastated to have discovered this at 39. I really didn't know that at the time. Like, I really kind of thought, and I mean, it's borne out in the arc of the season. I really thought the question of will Graham cheat on Patty was still sort of ahead of us.
Yeah, you know? Like, it was a question as opposed to something that was obviously answered from the start.
Yeah, and happening, and could be happening repeatedly. Like, we'll meet another woman as the series goes on that he will also get embroiled with, for better or worse. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm remembering now that he tells his brother that it never actually happened. But it's like, I don't know. It seems to me like there's a pattern of adulterous behavior for Graham that is the direct result, as I was saying earlier, of this smothering feeling. And that's fine. You know, God bless him. Has to deal with his relationship in his own way. But it was really surprising to me that until now, I kind of refused to read the scene as what it is obviously intended to communicate, which is that Graham's having an affair.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it's interesting for me. When I watched the show as a teenager, I definitely did understand that Graham was having an affair, but I felt kind of ambivalent about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily hate Graham because he was betraying his family, and I didn't necessarily feel that bad for Patty because she had her own problems. And
yeah.
And like, so it was just one of those things that I just thought of only in the abstract, maybe because it seemed so far removed from anything that I had any actual experience with. It just didn't,
right.
You know, my parents had a solid marriage.
So did mine.
And I had never, like, the idea of being married was so far away. The idea of being married and then having an affair was twice as far away. Like, it just had nothing to do with my life. So I didn't relate to it, but I also didn't really react to it very strongly, probably just because it was something that had never kind of entered my real life in any particular way. And watching it now, I felt I had like a much stronger reaction to it. And I felt simultaneously, like, very conflicted. I felt really sort of more angry with Graham than I had previously. And also like frustrated that Patty doesn't seem to realize what's happening in her own life. And that like they're having these conflicts, but their conflict is so much larger than what they are able to acknowledge or deal with. And like, I just felt kind of bad and frustrated and angry at everyone. Much more so. I clearly had a far stronger response to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it was interesting because, at the time I remember noticing like, oh yeah, he's probably having an affair, but I kind of didn't care that much.
Yeah.
And now I feel like, what the hell is anyone doing here? Yeah. What is going on?
Yeah. What
they
the
need
fuck?
To sort this out. Yeah. Ah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
So that takes me to the end of my notes on this episode. Were there any other moments or beats you wanted to call out before we move on to our real lives?
Oh, yeah. Actually, yeah, there are a couple of moments that I didn't, that didn't strike me at the time, that did strike me on this rewatch, that were just kind of interesting examples of how teenage girls deal with boys, mm-hmm. and also how the world expects them to deal with boys, and how this show kind of interestingly and skillfully portrayed that. And part of it was when Angela's reminiscing and talking about how she's only been kissed 3 times, mm-hmm. and the way she talks about it is so passive. Like, she has been kissed, but it's not like something that she did. Mm-hmm. It's something that someone else did to her, because that's how boys work. Like, that's how it is with boys, you know what I mean? Like, there's something about it that just kind of felt like there was no other way to phrase it, because that's how your first encounters with boys happen. It's that they do something, you know. And but then when she's in the car with Jordan Catalano and he like lunges forward to kiss her, she's like, hey, what are you doing? I was talking. And it's so much more active and so much more like it's a more assertive and better response than I think the average 15-year-old girl actually would even have in that situation, where you feel kind of overwhelmed and unsure of what to do, and you want the boy to like you, and he's done something you aren't that comfortable with, but you don't know how to speak up for yourself. And she totally does speak up for herself twice. And then, like, you know, and then he kind of settles down, and then she, you know, and then she wishes that he would try to kiss her again, because now it's like, okay. But I just really enjoyed the way that she didn't let him steamroll her in that first interaction, which I don't think that I took in or noticed at the time at all. Right. Like, it didn't seem like anything particular.
Yeah.
And this time I was like, oh, that's better than I would have remembered somehow. Like, her response is more...
There's a degree to which the Jordan, Angela... You know, because you see the entire thing from Angela's perspective always... Again, Jordan, a bit of an empty vessel. It sort of doesn't matter what he does, except when it wildly strays from what she is fantasizing about or hoping for. So I guess that's why the scene with the, in the, you know, where he doesn't know what day it is and the TV works, because he doesn't say anything, right? So she is just petrified to be in a room with him. And the fact that she gets out of the room alive, given that she's covered in mud and has a ripped dress, like, that's all she's thinking about in that moment. That's all that matters. Or at the end of the episode where, you know, he recognizes her at Let's Bolt. That can be a huge, huge moment for her, where just the fact that this idiot even knows she exists is like, oh, shit, that's great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Wait, was that in the second episode?
Yeah,
the
you scene jumped
that,
in.
Oh, damn, yeah, I'm sorry. Right. It's I didn't mean to watch 1 and 2 together, but I just couldn't stop.
Couldn't help yourself. No, it's very wonderful.
That's okay. But yeah, well, in that case, I will say the one thing that I found really amusing about the first episode was exactly that moment that you just brought up, when he recognizes her at Let's Bolt. And I just thought, she must feel really cool that A, he recognizes her, and she's B, being put into a cop car.
Well, exactly.
Which makes her seem so interesting and mysterious, and not just a dorky younger girl that he barely is aware of at school, but now she's got some mystique.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a reason for him to be intrigued by her, because she's leaving the club in a cop car.
Yeah, the whole Jordan-Angela relationship never really made sense to me in terms of why he would actually take an interest in her, except for that moment where I'm like... Out of context, she looks like a completely different person from who she actually is right then and there. And that's probably very useful for her.
Totally. Yeah. It's eye-catching.
Indeed. All right. So let's jump in the time machine and take a trip back to the day this episode aired. Now, according to the internet, so this was August 25th, 1994, and I copied this off the internet verbatim. A lot of this information would remain the same for the entire run of the series, but let's go with it. It was Thursday. It was the sign of Virgo. The U.S. president was Bill Clinton. He was a Democrat. In that special week of August, people in the U.S. were listening to I'll Make Love to You by Boys to Men.
Oh, Boys to Men.
In the U.K., Love is All Around by Wet, Wet, Wet was in the top 5 hits. Natural Born Killers, directed by Oliver Stone, was one of the most viewed movies released in 1994, while In the Kitchen with Rosie by Rosie Dale was one of the best-selling books. So that's what was going on when this episode aired. Natural Born Killers. There you go.
It's funny because my diaries from 1994 are all about how I went to see Pulp Fiction 6 times in theaters.
No shit.
Yeah.
We will probably get there. I also saw Pulp Fiction 6 times in theaters. We will probably get there towards the end of the year, but it wasn't the case now. So do you want to read yours? Do you want me to read mine? Who goes first here?
I guess I could read mine. All it's right, not from exactly that date, but it's the only August entry, unfortunately.
Closest
August entry for 1994. Are yours actually like... digitized?
Yes, I have digitized. Yeah.
Is that because you wrote them on a computer at the time, or because you transcribed them later?
I was
later?
A big Doogie Howser fan.
That
I wasn't actually a Doogie Howser fan. I was just like, oh, that seems like a good idea. Let's do what that kid's doing.
That seems really advanced. I didn't think to do that. I still actually don't do that. My diaries are still on paper.
Well, then they're not searchable.
That's true. I had to go through, Colin, my husband, wanted me to bring the 2 gigantic bags of notebooks that I had to search through in order to find the correct years.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, it'll be funny. Just do it for effect. I was like, then I have to take a taxi instead of a 10-minute walk.
Yeah, it's an expensive effect.
All right. So this is from Thursday, August 11th, 1994 is the closest that I have to the date that the pilot aired. So I was about 16 at the time, I guess grade 11,
mm-hmm.
and I was going through a really unfortunate hippie phase.
Okay.
So that's all the context you really need. Thursday, August 11th, I found this head shop on Young at Bloor, from whom I bought a tape of the, a videotape of the Merry Pranksters trip. They also have this great Velvet Underground poster, and they have Neil Cassady's book, The First Third, which literally nobody has that book. Anyway, we're going on vacation, and I thought I'd write a pre-trip note. We're leaving this Saturday. Tonight after work, I went for a piece of cake with Aaron from Goldfarb. Goldfarb is the place where I had my part-time job.
Okay.
He's really cute. Funny, too. I'm going to work tomorrow to take a picture of him so I won't forget what he looks like. I have, by the way, forgotten not only what he looks like, but also who he was at all. I have no memory of Aaron from Goldfarb.
All right.
I also want to give him On the Road by Jack Kerouac because he doesn't know who that is. Well, he's heard of him, but he wasn't too sure. Anyway.
That's wonderful.
the final sentence is, anyway, I'm having some uncalled for thoughts about him. I don't know why, but he is cute.
Awesome. So you don't even remember him.
I really don't.
So we can't really discuss. Obviously, that didn't go anywhere.
Clearly not.
Yeah.
He was clearly... I did look ahead in the diary to see if he appeared again, and he was a student. He was like... in university, he was maybe 2-3 years older than me, and he had a part-time job for the summer, I guess, where I worked. And so perhaps the reason I planned to take a photo of him was because he was going to be going away to college again. And so he wouldn't be working there anymore by the time I got back from vacation. But I honestly don't remember who he was or what he looked like.
Fabulous.
I should have taken that picture, clearly.
Clearly, and taped it into your diary.
Exactly.
Do you remember where the vacation was to?
Yes, we took a really awesome vacation, actually, family vacation to, the West Coast. I believe we flew into Calgary and then rented a car and drove over the Rockies and went to Vancouver and Victoria and then flew back.
Okay. Yeah. And just to like lay the table in terms of, cause I mean, obviously we're going to be going into teenager diaries. We should be clear about all this. Where were you in your dating life at that point? Had you dated, like what was your experience level?
So had this show premiered in July, we would have been reading the diary entry where my first real boyfriend broke up with me.
Mm-hmm.
But I had started sort of vaguely dating late grade 10, early grade 11, something like that. And I had my first like real relationship in grade 11 when I was 16. So 94. And it maybe lasted about 6 to 8 months, something like that.
Wow.
But it was the first one that was like serious, like more than a couple of dates kind of thing. Yeah.
you can pretty much ditto that for me across the board, with the exception of, instead of 6 to 8 months, it was 6 to 8 days. I think I had my first girlfriend in March, I want to say, of 94. And it was someone that I'd known for some time, but like for about, you know, a little more than a week, we would hold hands going places and make out. And then otherwise,
and that was that.
It was business as usual.
Yeah, I guess it was closer to 6 months in my case, because I remember one of our first dates was right around Valentine's Day. Like, yeah. I remember that was extremely early on in the relationship. And then the breakup entry in my diary is around my birthday, which is mid-July. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, February to July-ish, I guess that was my first serious relationship.
Cool. And I think it probably bears mentioning that... the names have not been changed in any of these diary entries to protect the innocent.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So people that I still know will...
apologize to everybody.
I'm very, very sorry.
It's going to be hit. Do you remember the Dragnet feature film from 86?
I don't think I ever saw it. I remember that it exists, yeah.
It's got one of my favorite opening, because, you know, the whole names have been changed to protect the innocent. Came from Dragnet, and they say at the beginning, for example, George Baker is now Sylvia Wiss. And then, like, Sylvia Wiss is a character, and it is a woman, and it's like, you know, like, it plays out through the whole thing, that this idea that this is actually a man, and that all of those scenes being played by a buxom Playboy model-style woman. Anywho, my entry from the day is both the best and the worst that we could start with for the purposes of this show.
I'm glad, because mine, I felt, was... kind of innocuous, like sort of embarrassing for me to read, but actually not really about anything.
Yep.
There are more crushingly embarrassing ones that I'm sure we will get to.
This is embarrassing, and I want to apologize to the people involved before I read it.
Oh, because, I can't wait.
And also to you guys, because it'll only amuse me. But here we go. 8/25/94, and I quote, Sandy. Social event, Sandy. Swimming, stars, Sandy. Scott, Sandy. Psychotic dream, Sandy. Spielberg, Sandy. Secret of Net 2, Sandy. Stupid, Sandy. Summer's End, Sandy. Silly, Sandy. Something to think about.
That's amazing.
Isn't it? I couldn't believe, again, I didn't check any of these entries before we did this. I couldn't actually believe that was the first one I was going to have to read, because that is horribly embarrassing. horribly embarrassing. My goodness.
So tell us about Sandy.
So Sandy, I guess the first thing that I should say is that Sandy is still a very, very dear friend of mine and a wonderful person. And yes, I had a colossal crush on her in that, which I guess pretty much what this entry is trying to convey is that probably is when it started. Like, Sandy was someone I kind of knew up till then. And I, again, God forbid I actually write detail in my journal. I don't know what it was that kicked this off. Social event is what I said, to keep with the everything starts with an S convention. But something must have happened that sort of kicked off the, oh, should I be considering this person? Or no. And then I went ahead and, you know,
deeply considered
Sandy for a very, very, very tumultuous, probably for the entire run of my so-called lifetime. Like the whole Sandy drama played out between about August of 94 and December of 94. So I suspect future journal entries will further
feature Sandy,
delve into Sandy. Now, there are some details here that I think are obvious, like Spielberg. I was really into that guy. Secret of Net 2 is actually the movie I didn't even know this was going to happen. The movie that I was mentioning earlier, one of the ones that I was making to get revenge on my father for showing Secret of Net 1 so much. So that I can drill down. No idea what the psychotic dream would have been, or whether it was Sandy related. No idea where we were swimming, because I don't remember ever doing that. But actually, you know what? Sandy might have had a pool in her backyard. That might have been it.
I can't believe you would have forgotten if Sandy had a pool in her backyard.
Right? No, I think she did, and I think that could actually be the social event in question. But yeah, who the fuck is Scott? Like, who is Scott? I don't know any Scotts. I know a Scott now, but I didn't know a Scott then.
Was he your rival for Sandy's attention?
It's possible, but I feel like I would have known that. And also, I did have a rival for Sandy's attentions, but he wasn't named Scott. So I just don't know.
Interesting.
But is that like angsty enough for what we're doing right here? Like, I just repeating a girl's name over and over and over again until it's ridiculous?
That's pretty good.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty good too. So we'll catch up with ourselves, I guess, next week, and also with the further adventures of Angela and her group of friends as we continue to move on with my so-called life. We do have a Twitter. I don't remember what it is. But if you want to leave comments on this episode, you can go to modernsuperior.com where we are hosted, and subscribe to us in the iTunes store where we will almost certainly be by the time you are listening to this. And yeah, please feel free to leave us any feedback that you desire. We'd love to hear what you think as we go through my so-called life. Any final words, Ms. G? Uncle Gundy, sorry.
Sorry, Alyssa?
That's correct. That your
name? I'm glad I remembered. No.
All
no,
right.
I feel good about that episode.
Me too. Well, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Well, I've been living in the city when the days are shitty and the nights can't be so long. So now I gotta break away from my same old every day. I'm headed back where I belong. Just what I gotta do. Gotta tell them all and stick it where the sun don't shine.
Presentation of the Modern Superior Media Network.